Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this week's Netcast. We've got a massive show this week. We'll be checking in with the OSCERT team in Brisbane to get the skinny on some nasty new bind vulnerabilities. We'll hear from Paul Ducklin over at Sophos Antivirus about that company's latest malware and spam report. And we'll also hear from Brian Sarton. He was our sponsor interview this week. Now, normally our sponsor slot is quite short, but Brian is a very, very interesting bloke. We've gone nuts with his interview and we'll be playing about 10 minutes of that. But first, as always, we're joined by Munir Katadia from ZDNet Australia with this week's news. Munir, it looks like American authorities aren't too keen on having foreign hackers turn up and present workshops at Black Hat this year.
No, they're not. I'm not really surprised by this. I mean, you know, this terrorism thing is going quite crazy. But this guy is a German CEO, right? And he does training at Black Hat and he flew all the way there. And then he had a 4.5-hour interview and then was brought on another flight all the way back again.
Now, the skinny is, I mean, he's done these workshops for 6 years in a row. I think this was his seventh shot. He's better known as Halvar Flake, this man, and Thomas Dullien. Now, apparently what's happened is there's been no problem with him flying over representing his company to do this training because the company was contracted to Black Hat. But this year he just contracted directly, which meant he was in the employ of a United States company and thus ineligible to enter on the visa waiver program.
It is pretty crazy, isn't it? I mean, you know, just it's all to do with the lawyers. How good your lawyer? Can they get you through the loopholes?
Oh, God, it's not even lawyers. It's like you've been to the States. You know what it's like with those, you know, walking up to those immigration counters at LAX. It's sort of like going to the soup Nazi in Seinfeld.
It's really, really scary. I was surprised when I first came to Australia and I walked in and I spoke to the immigration people and they were so nice and it was such a big surprise. It was like, oh, my God, this is not what you get in the States. When they look at you, you just feel scared, whatever happens. Everything's totally all right. It's like, oh, shit, what have I done wrong? The way he's looking at me, I must have done something wrong.
No more visa for you. Come back, 2 months.
I wouldn't fancy a 4.5-hour interview. I guess he's just lucky he wasn't sent to Gitmo instead of back to Germany.
Yeah, well, it's nothing like the open borders of Europe where I think if you turn up to, I think I turned up to Madrid once and there was a guy sitting there with a cigarette hanging out his mouth. He just sort of grunted and went, here and grab my passport, stamped it, didn't even look at the picture page. But yeah, a little bit different. They'd like to do things a little bit differently in the land up over.
The worst of it is, though, that now this guy is totally buggered when he wants to go back again because now they won't let him in on the visa waiver program and he has to get a full business visa and stuff if he ever wants to go back to the States.
The fun never stops.
No.
Now, look, there's been another typical malware report, which we've actually got Paul Ducklin coming on the podcast a bit later to discuss this report, but Sophos put out a fairly interesting malware roundup report.
Oh, this is the one about the webborne security attacks going through the roof, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is stuff we've been talking about for quite a while where, you know, you forget about getting attachments in your email anymore. Instead of opening up attachments within your email and getting owned that way, you just have to visit a website. And if you're not fully patched up or if it's exploiting some sort of unknown vulnerability, then you just get your Trojan that way.
Yeah, so it's become the more popular vector for owning people. And I don't think this is really news, but it's nice to see some hard-ish data supporting it, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is something which I really think, you know, we talk about education and stuff. This is one of the things that we've been writing about quite a lot and saying, you know, are there any trusted websites left? Because you can block some dodgy websites, you can stop people looking for, wares and that kind of stuff. But what if they're just, you know, trying to plan their weekend? You don't really want to stop them doing that, do you?
Now, this one is quite interesting. Facebook apparently is evolving into a bit of an attack tool or could evolve into a bit of an attack tool, you know, for people who are after identity theft. Now, I must say, when I set up my Facebook profile and it said, you know, do you want to display your birth date? I thought, hang on, full name, location, age, you know, birth date.
Well,
are
no.
you crazy? I mean, why don't I just put up my mother's maiden name and my PIN number?
Yeah, and the name of your pet, of course.
Yeah, now, of course, one of the things that makes Facebook so popular is all of these third-party applications that people sort of install on their profile. And these applications actually have access to all of that user's data. So every time you're installing one of these, you're potentially giving those application authors everything they need to basically take out a mortgage under your name.
Do you know what? It's kind of crazy. I would have thought, you're part of Facebook, and you know, we're on there, and we get these stupid notifications. Oh, you've been bitten by a zombie. You know, oh, look at this aquarium application or whatever it is. Those things are like viruses. You know, I mean, what is it? They replicate, you just click on it, and before you know it, it tries to send it to 20 of your friends. I mean, we've seen all of this kind of stuff before. But these are legitimate applications, I say in quotes, that people are putting onto their Facebook, and I think it's kind of dangerous.
Well, the reassuring thing is they can only access the information that you put up there. Now, I've got a habit of always putting an incorrect birth date and things like that. You know, just put it out by a day or a year or whatever it is, and it just, that will really throw a spanner in the works for someone who's trying to do a bit of ID theft on you.
But it also makes you look younger as well, right?
There is that. Yes, I'm a 26-year-old earning $200,000 a year. That's right. Yeah, so I don't know. It's one to keep an eye on anyway, because people do tend to be a little bit foolhardy when it comes to exposing, you know, information that could leave them open to ID fraud. So
there is. I think Facebook is a strange one as well, because the type of people that are on it, you know, I mean, there's all sorts. I remember I was on MySpace for a full couple of months or so, and it was like, okay, you know, it's like you're a 17-year-old and I'm too cool, you can't come to my party. But Facebook is totally different to that. It's like, oh, look, here's my friends and a few contacts, and this is what I'm doing if you're interested enough to have a look. And so I tend to have a lot more trust in it. You know, and it was very, very quickly I thought, oh, well, sod the privacy angle. I'm just going to go for it and do this. And I filled in my profile, and I really, really enjoy interacting with it. But with when Facebook opened up the applications, you know, the APIs, and now we've got, I don't know, 1,000 developers a day or whatever coming up with new applications for it, it's definitely something which we should keep an eye on and see where it goes.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, it's a way for those applications to collect data. I've got to say, on the privacy thing, one thing that I've just thought is the most hilarious thing I've seen on Facebook is I've got an editor who has kept his profile very much locked down. He doesn't, as a rule, add colleagues as his friends, because he likes to, you know, have Facebook as a bit of a friends thing.
Yeah.
And I finally understood why, because he's got these old mates who have a habit of uploading really embarrassing photos of him from 10 years ago and tagging him. Yeah. I think there was one, there was one recently involving some fake boobs and a bit of nudity, and it was just, you know, you can really understand why you'd want to keep that one private. But
and are you going to expose this person now on your podcast?
Absolutely not.
Go on, tell us who it is.
It will never happen. You know who I'm talking about, Munir.
I'm not saying anything.
Now, consumer advocates are apparently going to fight this New Zealand banking code. Now, we've discussed this on the podcast, and there's been volumes, there's been tomes written about this, where basically the group of New Zealand banks have got together and said, hey, you know what? If you're a victim of phishing or you're a victim of a Trojan, that's your fault, because you haven't done your job in securing your system, and we might not, in fact, reimburse you for funds stolen out of your account.
It is really, really crazy, this code, and I can't believe it actually is there and in practice in New Zealand right now, which is quite worrying. But, you know, I mean, we've been trying to write out and figure out, is it going to come over here? Hopefully, if this kind of action is successful over there, then it won't ever leave New Zealand, but I'm still not sure.
And I guess we've got to be careful not to, well, I suppose first off we should mention the advocacy groups, Internet NZ and the NZ Consumers Institute. They're the ones who are coming out swinging against this New Zealand Bankers Association code. But we should also point out that these codes, I mean, they're not a regulation. They're not actually anything official. So I guess, you know, this sort of stuff could be happening right now and we wouldn't necessarily know about it. So, you know, it's just a little bit concerning that they're prepared to come out and actually acknowledge that they're shafting consumers.
Oh, completely, yeah. And in this story, actually, there's James Turner, who's a security analyst for IBRS, and he makes a very, very good point. He says that end users shouldn't have to be security professionals. They shouldn't have to audit their own computers. This should be out of their hands. It's just pretty crazy doing that. And I totally agree with what he's saying there. I hope these people coming out and saying this really makes some sort of difference, but I've got to say I'm not optimistic.
Yeah, well, I just reckon SMS-based, you know, authentication or voice-based authentication, out of band, two-factor authentication for everybody instead of these draconian codes that are going to strip consumers of their rights.
I agree. Yeah. I'm with you.
I'm going to make a T-shirt. We can sell it at festivals. All right, Munir, thank you very much for joining us again this week.
It's been a pleasure, mate. Talk to you soon.
ZDNet Australia's editor, Munir Kataria there. We'll be right back after this.
Leverage your network for competitive edge with high-performance networking solutions from Juniper Networks. Juniper helps businesses to innovate, grow, and strengthen their business by accelerating the deployment of services and applications. Contact us at 1-300-458-647 or visit us at juniper.net.
And welcome back. You're listening to Risky Business, your weekly security podcast here on itradio.com.au. Now, our AusCert slot is back this week. We've got Carl Hanmore, AusCert's Operations Manager, on the line right now. So, Carl, what's been happening over the last week at AusCert HQ?
Oh, look, it's been a pretty busy week again. Unfortunately, it just never gets quiet in security. I think the big news from our perspective is probably some vulnerabilities in Bind9 that we announced and pushed an alert on, and the internet's been strangely quiet about.
So vulnerabilities in Bind. Now, Bind, of course, is responsible for most domain name lookups, isn't it?
That's right. And this specific vulnerability that's now come to light is around a cache poisoning attack. So you might have remembered these from your early learnings in IT security, that one of the ways to subvert the confidence in the internet is by getting the name servers to falsely report. So when you ask for www.myparticularsite.com, and instead of going to that site, you get sent to www.someoneelsessite.com.
Yeah, now I remember reading a really interesting case study about this. I think it was from Brazil, where someone had actually poisoned the DNS server on from a large ISP, so that people who were trying to go to their bank were instead directed to a dummy site.
Yeah, that's exactly the sort of attack that can occur with DNS cache poisoning. And this vulnerability, although not making it completely foolproof, actually significantly increases the odds that someone will be able to effectively poison the DNS cache. Normally DNS requires like a magic number involved, and you have to guess that effectively. This vulnerability highlights a mechanism whereby you can pretty effectively guess that magic number. You've sort of got a 50% chance on it being two specific numbers once you've done a little bit of analysis.
Okay.
So it's a pretty big risk there.
And is there a patch out?
Yes, there is. So people who are running Bind should update. The problem is, from a organizational user perspective, if your Bind relies on somebody else's, like forwarders, for example, if their Bind isn't up to date, you can fall victim to this attack even if you've done the right thing.
Sounds like a party.
It could be a big party on the internet, but everyone's strangely quiet on it. I think people have been very quietly and busily fixing their Bind implementations.
Yeah.
But people who are running Bind should definitely get this updated, because it will only be short period of time before the bad guys start to exploit it, I'm sure.
Now, also, Carl, this I'm sure will get the debate around DNSSEC raging again. Now, I mean, that's a much more secure proposed implementation for the domain name system, isn't it?
Look, it is, but I think DNSSEC is a little bit like IPv6. It's coming next week, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, okay, right. Oh, well, at least we get to look forward to the navel-gazing debate that is sure to ensue.
I'm sure there'll be a little.
Okay, well, Carl Hanmore, thanks a lot for joining us again.
No worries, Patrick.
AusCert's Carl Hanmore there. Up next, we've got an interview with Paul Ducklin from Sophos Antivirus. They put out a malware and spam report last week, which had some interesting findings in it. So we thought we'd bring on Paul to have a bit of a chat about that report. Paul, the last time Risky Business spoke to you, we were both in Germany.
We were indeed.
Yes, and how did you find CBIT in the end?
Well, I found it quite long, since I had to do presentations about every hour for 7 days.
That's the cost of glory.
It is indeed.
Okay. Now, Sophos's latest malware report is out, and you've discovered some interesting trends and a few interesting statistical tidbits.
Yes, I have. I guess the hardly surprising news, there's more malware than there was before. What's particularly interesting, though, is the rate at which it's now coming out. If you think viruses in their modern form came out about 25 years ago, the first one was in the early 80s, and that was number one. Now we're at number 250,000, roughly speaking, but of those, 50,000 have turned up in the last 6 months. So cyber criminals are really churning them out at a rate.
Well, I suppose they have to, so as to avoid detection by products made by companies like yours, Doug.
Well, I guess one way to put it is that it is an evidence of success that proactive detection is getting better and stronger. People are getting, you know, more conservative about what they're prepared to allow into their network and just blindly run. So we are forcing them to work harder, which is a good thing, because it actually increases the cost of them doing what you might loosely call business.
Now, another interesting aspect to this report is you've tracked where the spam comes from.
Yes, we by looking where spam comes into our spam traps, which are located pretty much all over the world, we're able to see, you know, who's doing badly and who's doing well in terms of sending spam. Now, what usually happens is that the US and China vie for first and second spots simply because of their high connectivity, their large population, heavy use of the internet. And the good news in there is, well, sort of good news, is that Australia comes in at 36th point on the World League table, relaying 0.4% of the world's spam, which is quite creditable given the population of the country.
Now, I think what's going to be interesting too is you've provided us with a little map that you've drawn up of where the spam's coming from. And with your permission, I'd like to put that on the site for our listeners to have a look at.
Yeah, please feel free to do that. The important thing about that map is most of the maps you'll see, it shows, you know, where spam came, where spam was seen from anywhere in the world to anywhere in the world. So what I did is I tried to turn that around and I looked at you know, where is spam coming from that ends up specifically inside Australia?
Yeah.
And the particularly interesting thing about that to me was, well, two particularly interesting things. One is that there are dots all, this is just for a month, by the way, there are dots all over the map, and there's a huge sort of lump in Europe and in the US and in Southeast
Asia.
Well,
now, Paul, just let me cut you off there. This is what I found interesting, is if you look at where the spam actually comes from, it's almost like looking at a map of where the money is, where people can afford computers. North America is hot. Europe's hot. You know, a little bit through Central America and then Southern America. China, surprisingly, not too huge. Japan is massive. So it really is about looking at where the major centers of commerce are and where people enjoy good living standards, because that's where the botnets live.
That's right. But although what I did find interesting is despite the relative lack of opportunity that people have in Africa and the fact that it's not well wired, although it wasn't actually smothered in spam dots, they were distributed right throughout the entire continent. So that, you know, it pretty much means that whether you're paying $1 a month for your internet access or $1,000 a month and struggling to get online, run a business online, the cyber criminals don't care. They'll steal your internet access regardless of where you are. So watch out.
Unscrupulous.
Indeed.
Interestingly, you found that 4% of locally received spam is actually sent from within Australia, but only about 0.4% of spam worldwide is sent from Australian bots.
Again, when looking at the map, I imagine that, you know, that it would, as you said, it'll be shining bright in Japan, in Korea, in China, in the US, in Europe, etc. And I hope that 0.4% of the world spam that Australia contributes would be reflected in the spam inside Australia. But it seems that we spam ourselves at 10 times the rate that we spam everyone else. And when you think about it, that's probably not surprising, because if you interconnect two computers in Australia, you tend to get a faster, better connection than if you connect a computer from Australia to the UK.
So you think it's more about latency?
I can't prove that, but it seems reasonable that, you know, the closer you are to someone else, the more likely you are to do them harm when it comes to spamming. Certainly what it means is if you redraw the sort of spamming or relist the dirty dozen countries in terms of spamming with for the spam that's come into Australia only, then what you find is that the top 10 are about the same as they are in the worldwide stats. The US and China sort of flip places. Korea's still third. All the other European countries, Brazil in there as well, and India are also in that list. But one of them drops off and one comes in, and the one that comes in is Australia, and it comes in at fourth place.
Mm.
So what that means is if we actually clean up our own act in terms of, you know, getting bots off computers at home and at work, then not only do we go down from 36th position worldwide, is we actually make a big difference to spam in Australia, because, you know, we're fourth on our own Dirty Dozen list, but only 36th on the Dirty Dozen list for the whole world.
So why aren't ISPs blocking outbound port 25 SMTP traffic then?
Well, many ISPs are blocking or at least regulating and throttling that traffic, and they're doing that no charge to their customers. And this can be a very good thing, because it does give them a fighting chance to cut off or to regulate the connectivity of customers who appear to have lost the plot, who are sending out lots of spam. On the other hand, it can be a little bit inconvenient because it means all the email must be routed through the ISP. They then have a responsibility for actually doing the delivery or non-delivery receipts for every customer they have. So although they're doing that, there is a cost to ISPs for doing so. And the other problem is if they try and get too clever and they go, oh, that person sent you know, 3 emails in 10 minutes instead of their usual one, we're going to cut them off. You know, is that really fair? So there's an element of that they're sort of damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Paul Ducklin, true conundrum if ever there was one. Thank you very much for the update.
It's a great pleasure.
That was Paul Ducklin there from Sophos. Now, anyone who's interested in seeing that map Paul put together can find it on itradio.com.au in the post for Risky Business number 24. He also did a couple of extra maps just for our listeners after we did that interview. So if you get a chance, head to the website and check them out. It's time for this week's sponsor interview. Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust, sponsors this podcast. So each week we get one of their experts on for a shortish interview. This week, however, we've decided to run long. The company had one of its most schooled up forensics experts out here, Brian Sarton. This guy's resume is incredible. With more than 10 years practicing as a computer forensics examiner, Sarton now leads Verizon Business Security Solutions' investigative response team. He's investigated 4 of the world's 5 largest data compromises. He's experienced in both civil and criminal IT investigative matters, and often serves as an expert witness. Our decision to run long on this interview had nothing to do with Verizon Business Security Solutions. They have never interfered with the editorial direction on this show, which is tops. But so is Brian, so I just couldn't edit this one down. I started by asking Brian if computer forensics is a discipline that's moving away from being a tiny niche into a full-blown wholesale type service.
I think one of the greatest trends that we've seen, in particular with engagements in Australasia especially, is if you look back over the years, particularly if you're familiar with Operation Firewall and the time frame before that, you know, back then when we conducted IT investigative work around data compromises, well, those were criminal cases, just like they are today. However, the tools and methods that were employed by the hackers, the way they were able to get a hold of the data and get it out of the companies they were targeting was always very impressive, and we were forever finding zero-day exploits and vulnerabilities in the process that were quite unique. However, these days, obviously, it doesn't seem like organized crime to such an extent is directly involved in the breaches themselves, and there's much more of a division between who are the hackers who get the data and who are the fraudsters who try to purchase and use that stolen data to their advantage. It has become very clear, particularly in the engagements we're responding to here in Australia, New Zealand, and in Southeast Asia, is it's not people inside the organization, it's more partial insiders. It's anybody who has access to this sensitive information, and people understand that when there is sensitive data like consumer information, identity-related data, particularly multiple types of records relative to an individual, well, that carries a value to it. The information black market has become large enough now that there are so many outlets they can sell that data. So if there are disgruntled people, somebody doesn't like their job, they don't like their circumstances, they need a little bit of money, they're financially unstable, whatever the case might be, that there are so many places where they can take this information they have legitimate access to and convert that information and that access into cash.
Now, that's interesting that you mentioned the underground market for information, because I attended a presentation at the AusCert conference, which is a security conference on the Gold Coast each year. Mm-hmm. And I saw a presentation by a fellow from one of the banks who really was talking about that underground information economy where you've got, you know, all different types of people who plug into this large organizational structure. So you'll have the people who do the breaches, but the people who gather the data aren't the ones who exploit the data. Now, what you seem to be saying is you're seeing evidence of the organizational structure of the illicit underground information economy. You're actually seeing that on the ground now.
Yes, no question. And to be more specific about it, you know, in the past, after Operation Firewall, I think organized crime still had a direct component. And when I say direct, that was because it was like a cash register effect. And so many of these cases would come in an identical fashion where we'd have 6 or 8 cases involving breaches on the same hardware software platform. You know, these cases would come in at the same time, and it was quite obvious at the onset that the cases were linked, you know, probably the same people behind it. Well, what it was a situation, we call them cash register cases, where, you know, hackers realize there's data on a system that they can take, maybe data that shouldn't be there. They know how to convert it to a usable fashion and how to sell it. Well, they, you know, it's like having a certain kind of system. There's a vulnerability on it. It's like a cash register. You know, on a make and model of the register, well, certain way you can bump it, the drawer pops open, you take the cash and run. They just have to find all the people who purchased that. Well, in the past, it was very clear that as if organized crime was going after companies who had this software directly. Now, and also in the past, as much as a year ago even, if you wanted a who's who listing of companies who'd been victimized in the past, well, you could go to the vendors' websites, some of these software companies out there, particularly who make payment applications, and look at their listing of referenceable customers, and there was a great listing of companies who'd experienced breaches before, and they just walked through that listing. Now, these days, though, it's as if things are changed. Instead of getting after that data directly and subjecting themselves to potential prosecution, it's as if they're going after disgruntled insiders, but especially partial insiders. The people who support that system for an organization, the people who sold it to them and had connectivity during that process, the people who support the mainframe, provide software support for a database server, who have connectivity with the companies. And it's as if they're using their level of access, in some cases, illegitimately, for the purpose of getting out that data and getting it out.
And what are the forensic tells of, you know, how can you tell that it's actually someone with a bit of insider knowledge? Is it glaringly obvious when you're pulling down a system and doing some recovery on it that, hey, you know, whoever did this knew their way around this box?
Yeah, well, that's actually a couple of different ways. You know, a lot of times in these cases, particularly when it's a situation like that, a partial insider case, there's certain things that a vendor will know that the end user won't know about the product. For instance, you know, oftentimes platforms that handle sensitive data, well, the manner at which they handle that sensitive data, particularly when it's managed by the vendor, it's locked down, and it's generally speaking these days going to be configured compliant with whatever regulatory rules are subjected to that data. Take payment card data, then they'll configure it according to PCI standards. Well, a lot of these platforms have the ability to enact a troubleshooting feature or a diagnostic utility that is something that the end user would not have access to. Well, the vendor does. Someone all of a sudden trips this diagnostic utility at 8 o'clock in the morning. Then they connect later on to download all the diagnostic logs, including raw dumps of the PIN information and what it takes to counterfeit the cards.
Nice.
And at the time, they turn that facility back off again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You think that it's got to be the vendor. Now, another way to look at that, which is more simple, and this is true in most of these kind of partial insider cases, is oftentimes it's circumstantial evidence of fraud or security breach that gets us involved, and we have to prove or disprove. And maybe there's fraud patterns or common point of purchase analysis, or there are customer complaints of identity fraud that get us engaged. Well, we say if all this data was stolen in a security breach on your network, show us the handful of systems that had to get hacked into in the process. And, you know, very specifically, we look at these systems, and from the time at which the data with fraud on it or the accounts with fraud were written into that system until the time they went fraud, only one person touched that data. That was the vendor. And I can prove that. Now, the issue is, in almost every one of these cases, as you go to the vendor and find out in their support center, there are 70 different people who use that same login name and password. So how do we distinguish one from the other? And because of liability, the vendor oftentimes will clam up and won't provide information like activity or incident information that might reveal who actually did it.
So they won't let you take their stuff and put their testicles in a vice?
No, they won't. But there are many cases these days where these kind of situations I've described, that might sound unusual, but they're not. I'd say this is becoming very par for the course for our cases these days. And there are many situations where groups of banks, associations, class action lawsuits and situations like that put sufficient enough pressure on these vendors that they cooperate with the investigation and allow us on site to pursue this stuff.
Now, Brian, I know you're a forensics expert. That's what you do. But it really seems like forensics is the one discipline which is the most time-consuming, the most expensive. It almost seems like the weakest link in the chain when we look at, you know, security from the perspective of breach through to a successful prosecution. It seems that for every minute someone spends owning your system, you need to sink 60 minutes at $500 an hour getting a forensics expert to painstakingly trawl through logs, disk images, and whatnot, cataloging stuff in a very serious way.
Yes.
Do you think that forensics has gotten easier, and do you think it's going to continue to get easier? Do you think we're going to start seeing a level of automation in forensics which, you know, really brings the cost down and makes it easier for law enforcement groups and private enterprise to basically provide evidence to the judiciary to speed up prosecutions?
Well, I would not say that it's necessarily getting easier. There are really sort of two thresholds that come into play. In the long run here, yes, I mean, the tools become more sophisticated over time. They help us, the forensic investigators, do our job better. But That's the role of anti-forensics. It's something that is used by the perpetrators, by the hackers and fraudsters against us to purposefully contaminate the crime scene and to make it such that, well, we can see who did it, what they took, understand the financial damages, but there's not enough to prove it in court. And that's where those two thresholds that I mentioned come into play. The first threshold is understanding the financial extent of the breach. Well, you get on site, you prove or disprove security breach. If you prove it, can you prove that that security breach led to the compromise of data, maybe what was in the fraud patterns or the customer complaints of identity fraud? And if you have that, that link between compromise and security breach, that's your smoking gun. And you use that to document, source, full extent, ensure the situation's contained, limit impact to the consumers, and set the stage for prosecution. So with that said, anti-forensics tools give the hackers the ability, maybe we can see, yes, there was security breach, yes, there was compromise and who was behind it, but for prosecution, it's not like a civil case. These are criminal cases, and for prosecution, it's not about overwhelming circumstantial evidence. There has to be dead set proof or conclusive evidence that this individual had actions that led to the compromise of this quantity of information with this cost associated to it, having these damages to the following individuals. And without that level of proof, these anti-forensics tools make it such that if you really want that evidence of proof, it makes the cost of getting that last nth bit of information to really set the stage for prosecution that much more expensive. If you want to understand the financial damages and make sure it's contained, well, that's becoming easier. There's no question. But if you really want to set this up for prosecution, that's the thing that's becoming very expensive. There's no question about that.
Okay. Well, Brian, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Verizon Business Security Solutions' Brian Sartin. He'll be back on next week's podcast to expand on his comments around anti-forensics. He's got some great war stories you'll want to hear. And that brings us to the close of this week's podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast using the links to the left of the posts. We'll be adding a subscribe by email function to the site soon, and we'll be doing a registration drive. That means prizes. CyberTrust gym bags, risky business t-shirts, and, most likely, a $3,500 ethical hacking training course to be delivered in Sydney. More on that in the next couple of shows. We've got to confirm that. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.